This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
What do I hear? Echoes in the heat. 100,000 people talking with their feet.
Climate and security analyst Genevieve Gunter and her new book, Fossil Fuel Propaganda and How to Fight It. Canadian climate scientist Paul Beck with very serious new studies like turbocharged extreme weather on every continent, planetary insolvency by 2070, and jaw-dropping increases in hurricanes. Plus, my new song, Rotten at the Top. Program note for radio listeners, we live in unstable times. Climate science and activism is being actively attacked along with all progressive radio. In the unlikely event you can't find Radio EcoShock on the air, please check our website at ecoshock.org to get the latest show. Radio is so cool because no one knows you are listening. But your local radio station needs your help. Stations may need legal defense fees and other things. Find your local nonprofit radio station online and donate now, please. Let's keep free speech on the air.
Radio EcoShock.
These are times of harsh record weather, stunning heat, fires and storms. Governments, big oil and gas, they say they're working on solutions. New technology will clean carbon and we can all just keep burning down the road. Dr. Genevieve Gunter calls out the myths and lies running around, even in lefty conversations. Genevieve is founding director of the group End Climate Silence, and she's affiliate faculty at the Tishman Environment and Design Center at the New School. Gunther's latest book is The Language of Climate Politics, Fossil Fuel Propaganda, and How to Fight It, from Oxford University Press. From New York City, Genevieve Gunther, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you so much for having me, Alex. It's great to be here.
You have a doctorate in Renaissance literature, but now you speak at scientific and public events about climate change. What changed your track?
Well, in some ways it's a change of track. In other ways it's continuity. I've always been interested in the way that language works on us to create political ideas, to conjure up emotions, to give us new ideas, to warp and shape our thinking. This is, you know, what they thought that poetry was good for in the Renaissance. They didn't see it as something that was just, you know, for entertainment. They really did see it as a way to instruct people through the pleasure of reading. So I thought that was an interesting concept when I was working on the Renaissance. And, you know, it's a form of propaganda. It's a theory of propaganda. And so in some sense, my focus now on climate change and climate propaganda and disinformation is just an extension of my expertise in Renaissance literature. But of course, there are significant differences. And I can just say that, you know, I just started getting more and more concerned about the climate crisis after I became a mom. Because, you know, if he's lucky, my son is going to live out his life over the 21st century when either we're going to, you know, halt global heating or the climate is going to really start to unravel and start to break down the kind of stability of human civilization. And I just feel like I don't want to let that happen without at least doing what I can, bringing my skills, my talents, my resources to bear on this problem. So that's how it shifted for me. And it took a minute. You know, I had to read and do research into the literature of climate communication. I had to learn about the history of climate politics. I had to take college-level courses in climate science, the whole bag. But given that sort of research program, you know, I now consult with NGOs and climate-conscious corporations and policymakers on climate communication and fossil fuel disinformation.
Well, right now in the USA, street protests and activism are beginning to take off a little, but it's not for climate action. Americans and friends around the world are fighting off what they see as a more immediate threat, maybe losing democracy. Is there any room left for climate activism? And what happens if we let climate action slide for a while during the troubles in America?
Well, look, I have always said, no matter who is in office, that climate action is not a matter of consumer choice. It's not a matter of recycling. It's not even a matter of you personally choosing no longer to eat beef or no longer to fly or buying only clean energy to heat your homes or buying an EV. All of the things are great. Ultimately, they are important. But even if everyone did that, we would need systemic change. We need to rebuild our energy systems. We need to rebuild our systems of production and consumption. We need a massive renovation project, and that requires international coordination, and it requires the resources and the capacities of national governments. So fundamentally, climate change is a political problem. To my mind, any action that attempts to get the current regime out of office and attempts to delegitimate what they're trying to do is, in fact, a climate action, because that would be the first step to doing what we ultimately need to do, which is phase out fossil fuels and halt global heating.
I live in Canada, and I can tell you, if Trump installs 25% tariffs all around, our economy will crash. I mean, things are already unstable in the United States markets as well. How would you picture climate discussion and activism if another Great Depression happens?
Well, look, I mean, if a Great Depression happens, and God forbid that comes to pass, there will be a moment of rebuilding. There will be a moment of progress. There will be a recovery, and that would be a moment that we can use to, again, rebuild our energy systems, reroute production into low-carbon work, refashion the world so as to have an economy that, first of all, focuses production on human needs and the things that we know make people happier, you know, public spaces that are easily accessible, where you can interact with other people, excellent healthcare, shorter work weeks, you know, everything that we know leads to happiness and not just to accumulated wealth for the 1% and above. So in every crisis, there's much suffering, but there's also opportunity. So even if the worst comes to pass, I hope that it could be taken as an opportunity to transform our systems and halt global heating.
In a July 2024 YouTube interview with Emma Vigeland of the Majority Report, you two discussed nationalizing the coal, gas, and oil production for a government-prepared phase-out of fossil fuels. But I'm thinking, well, Norway and Saudi Arabia are just some of many nations with nationalized production, and they're not cutting back, even if we owned it all. Somebody will claim schools and hospitals will close without that revenue. What do you think? Is nationalization of fossil fuels a viable answer for the climate threat?
Well, I mean, each nation is going to have its own way to meet the challenge of climate change. Look, the planet is going to keep heating up until we zero out emissions. And it is currently heating faster than it's ever heated in its geological history, right? This is not a sort of nice to have. This is not kind of like a cultural or social issue that we can hash out over generations. This is a matter of the only planet we have that we know is habitable, that supports life in the known universe, having a climate where human beings can exist. The last time there was this much carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, humans didn't even exist. They hadn't evolved yet. When we talk about whether things are realistic or viable, it's really important to understand that the thing that's the most realistic here is the reality of the climate crisis and how dangerous it will be if we allow the planet to heat up 3-4 degrees Celsius by 2100 and then just, you know, keep on going after that. So each nation is going to have its own challenges, its own resources, its own history. I wouldn't obviously recommend nationalization in Canada, for example, but I think in the United States, certainly one thing that would need to happen is that the phase out of fossil fuels would need to be coordinated, and it would need to be done in a very just and ethical and equitable way. Because we don't have a social safety net in this country. We don't have public health care. We have very little public housing. Our unemployment insurance is paltry. I mean, if you shift production into new sectors, if you phase out sectors of the economy, people are going to really suffer unless it's done in a way that front loads justice and equity. So that's why I was talking about the fact that in the United States, you should nationalize the fossil fuel companies and do the phase out as a sort of very coordinated plan that leaves nobody behind and doesn't make anybody who isn't responsible for the climate crisis suffer, including labor in the oil and gas sector. So that's why I was recommending that in the United States. I wouldn't recommend that, obviously, for Canada, and certainly, you know, Saudi Arabia is just a country on top of a fossil fuel company. It's like there is no daylight between Aramco and the kingdom. So, you know, again, each country has its own challenges, but I was really just speaking about the domestic case in the United States.
Well, the key problem which you deal with in your book is our minds are filled with a lot of misleading language about climate, and some ideas in our listeners' heads were probably planted or defined by fossil fuel companies and their well-funded think tanks and their lobby groups and their media flacks. Is it merely academic to check out language, or does language itself kind of operate like a feedback mechanism that could delay action too?
I mean, you're absolutely right. This is my whole career, showing how language acts as a feedback mechanism and trying to intervene there and give people alternative things to say that will raise the support for phasing out fossil fuels, that will clarify our beliefs, and that will actually energize people and get them to sort of take on this climate fight. I did focus group polling after my book was completed on the messages that I developed, and it shows that for people who are already concerned about the climate crisis, the messages I give you in the book will help you raise other people's support among that group of people who are already concerned about the climate crisis by up to 10 points, which is a really significant shift. It's a very challenging thing to take on because, as you suggested, this kind of fossil fuel propaganda, which isn't just coming from oil and gas companies or their PR people or their lobbyists, mind you, it's also coming from inside academia and even the sciences and journalism and, you know, certainly the corporate world and all these actors who are somehow not exactly colluding, but sort of implicated in the fossil fuel economy and whose beliefs themselves have been created by this idea that we can just, you know, that we are separate from nature and we can just keep using technology to get richer and richer and richer and richer, and that there aren't any side effects of that. We can just handle with more technology. So this is a very sort of standard idea, and it's one of the dangerous ideas that gets constructed by our language. And I patiently show how that construction is a fantasy based on no evidence whatsoever, and sometimes it's based on contradictory evidence. And I offer you language with which to talk about it more broadly. And, you know, even if you don't necessarily feel that concern about the climate crisis for whatever reason, this kind of awareness of how language creates false beliefs in us and this capacity to sort of resist those false beliefs by having a kind of suspicion to the way things are represented in the news media or by elected officials is absolutely essential. It's an absolutely essential skill for everybody to have right now because of the rise of social media, the rise of disinformation, the rise of right-wing media that, you know, circulates propaganda, the rise of Russian troll farms, like all of it. This political moment we're in, you know, not just in the United States, but also in parts of Europe, you know, almost in Canada, if Trump had not threatened Canada with invasion, essentially, all of this sort of shift to the right, it is in part, you know, of course, a response to COVID and the economic upheavals that came in the wake of the pandemic, but it's also a response to this just flood of disinformation that has completely infected our media and political discourse that people aren't necessarily trained or even inclined to resist, to hear or resist. And it's nothing is more important right now than waking up to this and figuring out how to prevent it from getting into your ideas and how to talk about these problems that we're facing collectively in a new way.
So if we keep this fossil-powered civilization going, even Mar-a-Lago will go under the rising seas or get demolished in the next superstorm. The rich don't win when nobody wins, so why do you think investor titans and the executives in those big oil and gas companies keep searching for more carbon to put into the atmosphere?
Well, because I think they believe that the worst effects of climate change aren't coming for many decades, and that essentially they'll be dead and they don't have to worry about it. And I suspect that they think that even their children potentially might be dead before the proverbial manure hits the fan. So I think, you know, there's an element of fundamental, even murderous nihilism in those calculations. But also, I think there's a profound ignorance. I mean, even among people who believe that or understand that climate change is real, you know, most people know very little about the causes of the problem, the dangers of the problem, you know, the new research that keeps coming out showing that the worst impacts of climate change are slated to come down within decades. So, for example, so I don't think that these executives, these policymakers, these bankers actually even entirely know what it is that they're doing. And I feel that they probably profoundly don't want to know and would never need to know because they're probably surrounded by other people who also don't know and will never force them to look. And they think that the people who are trying to force them to look are just, you know, hippie freaks. So the Institute of Actuaries in the United Kingdom, which is, you know, definitely not a hippie organization. Actuaries are mathematicians who advise insurance companies on risk management. It is a very old and very storied organization in the UK. They came out a few months ago with a report that showed that if we do not phase out fossil fuels, if we continue on the trajectory we are in now, by 2070, which is, you know, when my son will be essentially my age, on the trajectory we're on now, in the worst case scenario, the global economy will contract by 50%. So, you know, here I am helping my son with his homework, you know, like giving him tips on the research paper he's writing for his history class, hoping that he will be able to use his education to have, you know, a vibrant and satisfying life and have children of his own one day. And here are the Institute of Actuaries in the UK warning that there will be a global, something worse than a global Great Depression starting when he's in his middle age. And it will be permanent because we will not be able to repair the damage that we have done. But these studies are released and they are ignored because it's just too conceptually difficult, it's too politically difficult, and in some ways, it's too emotionally difficult for people to metabolize them. So they just sort of, you know, bounce off like, I don't know, a rainstorm on a drought-hardened ground or something. People manage to distance it because people don't feel from their thoughts. They just look around them and think, oh, I'll be fine. Look, everything seems fine.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with our guest, Dr. Genevieve Gunther. Her latest book is The Language of Climate Politics, Fossil Fuel Propaganda, and How to Fight It. Now, picking up on what you just said, if a doctor tells me I have serious, maybe fatal cancer, I may decide to fight it with every tool. But some people go the other way, and they say, well, that doctor's just a quack, and medicine is right. The real cause of the disease. Isn't that the way the new American administration is going? And should we just see this as yet another climate shock? I mean, you just talked about how giant this problem is. It's so hard to face. People seem to go two different ways in reaction.
Yeah, I mean, they know. Let me just be clear. The Trump administration knows it's real. They absolutely know it's real. So the head of the Department of Energy that was tapped by President Trump, this guy Chris Bright, who's a fracking executive, he went to this huge fossil energy conference a few weeks ago called CERAWeek in Texas and said, yes, climate change exists, but it's just a side effect of building the modern world that we need to manage, right? So it's not that they don't know it's real. It's that they are misrepresenting it as something not threatening. at the Pentagon, Pete Hegseth, the Secretary of Defense, wrote a memo instructing all agencies in the Pentagon, all departments in the Pentagon, to erase any mention of climate change from their documents. Meanwhile, they've increased the budget for adaptation and research into climate-friendly warfare and hardening the infrastructure of Army and Navy bases that are on, you know, coastlines subject to sea level rise. So they know they're pretty much consciously choosing to either pretend the problem doesn't exist by trying to wipe it from the record, and this is why they're dismantling NOAA and the EPA, because they're trying to create this really Orwellian structure of disinformation, of lies, that proceeds as if climate change isn't happening. But they know, because in other domains, such as national defense, they're still spending money on preparing for what's coming. But arguably, just like the fossil energy executives who don't really understand the problem, I don't think that anyone understands how that, or anyone there, believes that climate change is going to weaken the power of the United States Army within the next 10 to 20 years. So they don't care. They're just going to die and leave the mess for the rest of us to clean up.
You know, on the other side of the pond, the Global Systems Institute at the University of Exeter is a key European hub. Their founding director, Tim Linton, has been on Radio EcoShock several times. You will be speaking at the upcoming Global Tipping Points conference there in July. How concerned are you about tipping points, and is that a good entry point for public discussion and action?
Well, let me just say that there are actually two conferences going on at the Global Systems Institute simultaneously, one about tipping points and one about the climate challenge, the politics of climate change more broadly. And it's the second one I'll be speaking at, although I have submitted an abstract for the tipping points conference, and I will attend it whether or not the abstract is accepted. I just wanted to sort of, you know, be pedantic and clarify that. To answer your actual question, I'm extremely concerned about tipping points, largely because we don't know where they are, really. And I don't think that is reassuring at all. Like, we have no way of ruling out the shutdown of the Atlantic overturning meridional oscillation, the AMOC current that brings heat out of the tropics into Europe. We have no way of ruling that out as something that might happen in the 21st century. And if that happens, you know, it's gonna rival, if not overshadow, the destructiveness of World War II. Like, the tropics will become uninhabitable, and it will be very, very hard to grow food in Europe. And it won't happen overnight. It won't happen in a year. It'll happen over a couple or, you know, triple set of decades. But, you know, the amount of upheaval and what that might do to our politics and what kind of wars that might start, it's absolutely terrifying. And once those tipping points are tipped, you can't put them back together again. You know, it's not even in the Japanese technique of trying to glue things back together with a beautiful gold glue and showing the cracks. No, once those tipping points tip, they are not going to be repaired except by the planet itself, and that will happen much, much longer than one human lifetime or even one human culture or even humanity itself. So I'm extremely worried about them, and I don't think that they're well understood, and I feel very frustrated that there isn't more attention to them in public discourse because, you know, the real point is that later is too late. We can't keep putting this off and think that we can do it later and get the same result. Later is, in fact, too late.
You founded the group End Climate Silence. What is the point of that?
So End Climate Silence I founded after this afternoon when I was listening to the radio, and I heard three stories that were clearly climate stories. One was about a rancher who had to truck in sort of 18,000 gallons of water to his ranch every day to water his cattle because his land was, you know, desiccated from drought. Another one was about I think it was the flood in Japan that year that displaced 3 million people. And I don't remember at this point what the third one was. Oh, yes, it was some interview with some French technologist who talked about autonomous vehicles driving around everywhere on the planet, you know, with no acknowledgement that all of those vehicles needed to be electric whatsoever. In none of these stories were the words climate change even mentioned. Like, it was as if climate change didn't exist. It was this weird form of denial which just pretends the problem isn't happening. And I started to realize that that kind of silence, that kind of climate silence, that kind of low-key climate denial, oh, this isn't really happening. Even when the story is clearly a climate story, was ubiquitous in the U.S. media. So I felt that this was a huge problem because it prevented people, A, from knowing what was happening, and B, allowed climate denial to flourish. So I started this volunteer organization, and which, like, a very limited mission, which was to try to get journalists to actually mention climate change in the stories they were reporting in which climate change emerged, even if it wasn't explicitly like a science or environment story. And, you know, we were very active for the first few years, and I do think we changed the paradigm so that now, you know, reporters on any desk, energy, business, foreign affairs, politics, will occasionally mention climate change when they are reporting on something that is climate related. But, you know, it was very hard to get the TV news networks to do this. Even when they were airing segments on extreme weather, they wouldn't even mention the words climate change. Even when they were describing what science said about the relationships between global heating and the extreme weather they were reporting on, they wouldn't mention climate change. And that didn't really change. And then the pandemic hit, and one of our volunteers got sick, and we kind of scattered. And then much of our activism was actually done on then Twitter, because there was a very active and very organized climate movement that sort of gathered on Twitter that had the attention of policymakers and journalists. You know, we would try to do direct outreach, and if that didn't go anywhere, we would, you know, basically shame them on Twitter. And it was very, very effective, but now that doesn't exist anymore because Twitter became X, and now it's a, you know, a right-wing disinformation machine. And there are still are some, you know, there are many legitimate journalists, and there a lot of people are still on it, but engagement is entirely driven to advance right-wing interests, and so it doesn't have the same capacity to make change that it did before.
Well, I follow you on Blue Sky. For me, that's the place to be. We have to wrap up our time here. What are you working on next?
Well, right now I am writing a book review of Andres Malm's latest book. I am writing another book review on this book called Abundance, which I think is actually very interesting but quite misguided. I am writing my newsletter, the End Climate Silence newsletter, which you can subscribe to if you go to endclimatesilence.org and go to the tab that says newsletter, which has been about climate communication, climate disinformation, and how to talk about the climate crisis in more effective ways. But I'm expanding my focus into, as I suggested, authoritarian language in general. And I'm developing a podcast potentially called Climate Matters, in order to try to keep climate change in some sort of conversation despite the crisis, the political crisis we're facing in the U.S.
That's a lot. You can sign me up for all of that. I'm really going to be looking forward to your work. Genevieve, you can be found at genevievegunther.com, and you can also check out her latest book, The Language of Climate Politics, Fossil Fuel Propaganda, and How to Fight It. Genevieve, thank you so much for spending time with our listeners.
Alex, thank you so much for having me. It was great to talk to you.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
Crazy old men, heat's gone sour. Keep coming back again, holding on to power. Bad against the people, got to stop. Good on the ground, rotten at the top. Somebody, somebody, rock, rock.
Media spins leaked war plans and secret signals. Our lives are really on edge. Will we be canceled? All the while, scientists send snapshots of a planet changing too fast. That is the biggest news that will never be news. World food will crash, hurricanes will get way more powerful, plants are giving up, and nobody can keep up. But Canadian climate scientist Paul Beckwith keeps going. With a background in physics and climate, Beckwith is the largest pipeline of important new climate science on YouTube. From Ottawa, Canada, Paul Beckwith, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Well, thank you for having me, Alex. It's always a pleasure to chat with you.
Tell us about your latest video, Paul, on the turbocharged extreme weather.
A while back, I did a video on some new World Meteorological Organization reports that came out, and I think these reports get more and more important as we get fewer reports on climate science from the U.S. So this is a European organization and reports, and one of them was on the sort of state of the climate in 2024, and the other one was kind of a supplemental report to the overall state of the climate, and it was specifically on extreme weather events that happened around the planet in 2024. And the nice thing about this report and my video is that, you know, we're just inundated with information, like way too much information. There's lots of things happening. And this report goes on a continent-by-continent basis talking about extreme weather events. And, you know, even somebody like you or I who follows climate very closely will be very surprised by and not have heard of certain cyclones and typhoons and flooding events where hundreds of thousands of people lose their houses and a million people are evacuated. And we don't even know about it because it was in Africa or in South America. You know, we hear about the things in the West because we live in the West. We know what's going on in North America pretty well with Hurricanes Helene and Milton last year. You know, we know about the wildfires in L.A., but we don't know about the wildfires in Santiago, Chile, or the massive flooding. But the patterns are pretty clear. More and more places around the world are being hit by torrential rains lasting for many days, dropping, you know, up to a meter of rainfall. And that, you know, if it's on in an arid region that doesn't normally get rain, then it doesn't soak into the ground. It floods over land and you get literally up maybe, you know, up to a million people evacuated, hundreds of thousands of homes destroyed, towns destroyed. And it doesn't even make the news to us.
Related to what you just said about all these huge damaging events that happened in 2024, we can go backward in your YouTube feed to March 24th. Your headline there is, "We are heading to planetary insolvency. Climate disruption can wipe out half of global GDP by 2070. Our recent guest, Genevieve Gunther, picked up on this one too. Who says we could go broke because of climate?
Well, Timothy Lenton at the University of Exeter in the UK, they put out was one of the key authors of a report that came out with that very title, you know, Planetary Solvency, actually. And it made headlines around the world. It came out sort of towards the end of January of this year. And then it basically dropped off the radar completely in the news. So I've been doing some research on this report and on, you know, what people in the financial world, actuaries and people, insurance companies, how they evaluate risk. And the result is there's also some great peer-reviewed papers on, you know, the economic impacts of climate change. And more people in the finance industry are realizing that climate disruption could actually take out half of global GDP by 2070 if it continues unchecked. It could be higher than that, could be lower than that. You know, some economists say, well, if our economy grows substantially and, you know, people, the GDP increases like 3 times or 5 times or 7 times, then losing half wouldn't be so bad. But as Timothy Lenton cautioned in an Inside Climate interview, which is very good you know, very, very good sort of insightful interview about Timothy Lenton and his kids and his motivations to be concerned about the future. He's, of course, he published papers on, I think one was called Tipping Points in the Climate System, you know, back over a decade ago, you know, and these were sort of key papers on how there's many tipping points in the climate system. And these are underplayed in, you know, the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change assessment reports. They're not discussed much at climate conferences, but they are getting more notice, certainly in areas like the insurance industry that's being hit hard now by all the extreme weather events. So this is significant. I mean, half of global GDP by 2070. I mean, that's what we're facing with climate change.
And that comes from UK actuaries, and they are not, you know, radicals by any sense of the means. They're pretty down-to-earth people, and they advise businesses, major businesses, on risk management. So we're going to have to take another look at that one.
I mean, there's even references to sort of this idea of planetary insolvency. You can find references on the Bank of England site, for example, on the sites of the organizations that are sort of the umbrella organizations for all the actuaries in the UK. You can find them in other countries. So people are getting more and more worried about it. You know, and these are people that traditionally, you know, haven't paid any attention to climate change.
Okay, you posted another video on the same day, March 24th, and the title is Major Coastal City Risks, Alexandria, Los Angeles, San Francisco, From Sea Level Rise and Subsidence. That's based on two papers. Do you want to give us a brief picture of what's going on in Alexandria, Egypt, and then what are we worried about in San Francisco?
Well, global sea level rise is something that most people think of as, yeah, it's happening. It's happening slowly. It's not something that most people will have to worry about for many, many decades. But nothing could be further from the truth if you look at these papers that I discuss in this video, because, you know, Alexandria in particular has a very storied history. You know, it's a city that's been around for, 3,500 years plus. The famous Library of Alexandria was there. Cleopatra was from there. It's a coastal city, and with the sea level rise that they're experiencing now and in the past, there's a lot of salt water that's intruding into the groundwater underneath these tall buildings and ancient buildings. If there's any metal pilings underneath the buildings, they're corroding. But because the water table is brought closer to the surface by seawater intrusion, it's weakening the soils and the sands underneath the buildings. And we've had something like 280 buildings collapse in the last decade. And if you look at the collapse of buildings in the city over time, you know, it's spiking way, way up. So that's the first thing. The sea level rise is having real impacts on coastal cities at the moment. And, you know, a large majority of the population of the planet lives within short distance from coastlines. Then I did a bit more investigation, and I came upon a paper recently that was talking about sea level rise in places like Los Angeles and San Francisco, and there's a lot of variation within these cities. They're large cities, but on some coastal regions of these cities, especially those that were built partly on landfill, you know, if you look at the history of the construction of buildings in these cities, they use landfill on some coast to give them more space to build. Well, there's a lot of subsidence of those regions, and in fact, if you look at the net local sea level rise in some of these regions, it's actually double what the global sea level rise would be on that coastline without the subsidence. So the land is subsiding, it's going downwards, and sea level rise, of course, is the water's rising, so the effect is actually double in some of these places. And if you happen to be in a place where there's not subsidence, but the land is actually rising, it can almost cancel out sea level rise. So, in other words, you know, you can't look at the city as a whole and say you don't want to live on the coast in LA. You want to make sure you look at the specific neighborhoods and beaches and coastal communities, because you don't want to go on one where there's huge subsidence, which on top of sea level rise will likely be causing building collapses in the near future.
Last week, I warned listeners to expect a lot more scientists and authors on this show from outside the United States, you know, due to the Trump defunding and firings and the big chill down there. Some major American universities are trying to hide their climate research under a rug. They'll just call it weather or something. I just checked the science papers behind your last seven posts on your YouTube channel. Six of the seven have lead authors or all authors from Scandinavia, the UK, or Europe. Only the paper on sea level rise in California that we just talked about has two authors from NASA, and who knows if they will still be there. What are your thoughts on NASA and the future of climate science in America?
Well, it's pretty grim, obviously, right now, and, you know, what's even worse is that this labeling of people in the U.S. as being American or being foreign nationals is having a huge negative impact on collaboration between scientists in the U.S. and scientists in other countries, because many scientists in the U.S., not only have they lost their jobs if they work for the government or NOAA or places, but those in universities that do collaboration with scientists in other countries are basically collaborating with foreign nationals, and this could cause them great problems because they've been cautioned by the government that they need to limit their collaboration with foreign nationals. So it basically destroys the ability of people, scientists in the U.S., to work with scientists in any other country in the world. You know, if this continues and gets worse and is enforced, it basically kills science in the U.S. And, you know, fortunately, people around the world are working on climate change. There's lots of very good scientists. And also, you know, I think we're going to see a large exodus of scientists from the U.S. to other countries where they can do their work if the present situation continues. So it puts a huge damper, but I think it's only going to hurt the U.S. Maybe not in the immediate short term, but, you know, in the midterm to the long term, it hurts the country. It hurts the ability of the country to do cutting edge science, which then leads to cutting edge technology. You know, it's very backward heading, unfortunately. I look at China, you know, which has a culture of education, a culture of learning. If you look at the sheer numbers of people in the school systems that are, and people that are working in STEM areas, science, technology, engineering, and math, you know, in China, for example, I think there's three times as many engineers graduating each year than there is in the U.S. and, you know, in any other country in the world. So we're seeing the clean energy revolution taking off in China, originating in China with, you know, they produce 90% of the solar photovoltaic cells, which go in solar panels. They're leading in electric car battery technologies and electric cars, and like solar electrification is doubling roughly every 3 years globally, and most of that is being driven by China. They've just figured out how to charge electric car batteries in the time it takes to fill your gas tank, you know, in about 5 minutes to get a full charge that's using existing batteries with different charger technologies. So I think the U.S., there's a grave risk that the U.S. is just going to, how will they catch up if they hollow out their science and research? And, you know, eventually that will get to the military technology and the whole rest of it, and also the economies. I mean, if you base your economy and double up and go all in on fossil fuels now, well, the world is going to leave you behind, and you're not going to be have a viable economy at some point with that sort of action and behavior today.
Getting back to your YouTube feed, Paul, let's talk about this one, also posted on March 24th, your second in that day, and the title is Plants Reveal New Details of 10 Degree C Temperature Increase in the Big Daddy Global Mass Extinction Event 252 million years ago. Okay, I guess the question is, why do we care what happened 250 million years ago?
Well, what's interesting in this study is, of course, in that time period, the so-called Permian-Triassic mass extinction, I mean, we've had five major mass extinctions on the planet, and this was the largest of them. They call it the Big Daddy. of them, and some people are arguing that right now we're undergoing the sixth mass extinction, you know, with loss of species being much higher because of climate change and the rapid changes now. So, you know, maybe we can learn some lessons by studying previous extinctions to avoid avoid another one. If you look at the fossil record of the plants at the time before and after this extinction event, there's quite a huge difference in the plants. Like, they can look at the fossils and see what plants grew in a certain area, and we know how continental drift has changed the surface of the Earth. So we had one huge supercontinent at that time called Pangaea, and we can see the different types of vegetation stretching from the equator to the poles on this one continent, which stretched from the equator to the poles, and we can see how the vegetation changed significantly and how, you know, the isotopic signatures and stuff say that, well, yeah, the temperature increased, the global average temperature increased 10 degrees Celsius during that event, so hopefully we can learn more about it. But it's very applicable today, for example, with climate change, with temperature patterns changing, precipitation patterns changing. You know, many areas that are breadbaskets of the world today for growing food, you know, the staple crops, the wheat, maize or corn, rice, other grains, you know, as climate shifts, these areas shift. And most of the world will be able to grow less food, with the exception of Canada, northern areas in Canada, northern areas in Siberia and Russia. But then we need decent soils, so it will take time for those soils to develop. Yeah, I mean, agriculture globally will shift, and it'll become much harder to grow food to feed the growing population. So we can learn about the present day from what happened in the deep past.
For more on that food, you can check out Paul's video posted March 18th. It's titled Global Food Quantity and Diversity to Drop by More Than Half with Our Accelerated Climate Warming. And this is all based on science, folks. That article was published in Nature. He's not making it up. You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. We are talking with Canadian climate scientist Paul Beckwith. Next one up, Paul, I kind of touched on, and I've got more coming on this, but it's titled Tropical Cyclone Hurricanes Strengthen Energy to Undergo Jaw-Dropping Increases Over the Next 5 Years. We've suspected that would be the case, but now we know more?
Yeah, it's next 5 years, next few decades anyway, for sure. You know, the ocean's absorbing 90% of the heat. So when we talk about global warming, it's really, you know, mostly ocean warming. And then with warmer oceans, you get warmer atmosphere, and the greenhouse gases, you know, trapping the heat and so on. Any temperatures, ocean sea surface temperatures above 26.5 degrees means that you get amplification of these storms. And the other big factor that's equally important is we're getting a reduction of shear wind. So when you have a large tropical storm moving up the scale to eventually become Category 5 hurricanes, they call them cyclones in other parts of the world and typhoons in other parts of the world, there's about 68 of these storms per year globally. You know, we mostly think of the North Atlantic Basin and the hurricanes that come form sort of off Africa, come through the Caribbean, hit the U.S. Those are the ones that we tend to focus on, but there's many others in other basins. These storms need to organize to go up the scale and become superstorms, if you like, Category 5. But if you have shear winds, in other words, if the wind is blowing in different directions at different altitudes, then that works against organization of the storm. If you have very, very high shear, high altitude winds in different directions from low altitude winds, that can basically chop the top off these developing cyclones and limit their strength. What we're finding is that the shear is actually reducing significantly with climate change, and that combined with the warmer ocean temperatures means that we're getting more of these storms forming, and when they form, more of them are making their way up to Category 5 type storms. So this is like a double negative whammy for humans that live along the coastlines or even inland. I mean, we saw, you know, Hurricane Helene to cause huge billions and billions, I think something like 58, almost 60 billion worth of damages, and it caused huge inland flooding because it filled the rivers, which then took out towns and so on. So the damages were extensive inland from storms. So these, you know, I think James Hansen calls them super storms of our grandchildren when he wrote that book a decade ago, and they're happening today, it turns out.
Yeah, I hope to speak with the lead author of that cyclone paper, Paul Arthur Monnery. Maybe that'll come out next week. We'll see. He's from the National Center for Atmospheric Science at the University of Reading. Let's get to another paper where you and I intersect. Last week, I interviewed Australian super scientist Pep Cannadel about plants losing their ability to carbon capture, and you covered an earlier important paper and posted the video, Simple CO2 Keeling Curve Math Show Earth's Carbon Sinks Peaking Already in 2008 and Now Declining. Help us understand why this is such a frightening development for all of us.
If you look at the Keeling Curve, the famous Keeling Curve data collected on Mauna Loa in Hawaii since 1958, you know, it shows basically during the Northern Hemisphere winter, there's not plants growing, you know, it's colder, so the CO2 levels are higher, and then in the spring, they start to drop significantly as we reach Northern Hemisphere summer and the plants all come alive. And then it brings you down to a minimum within the year. And then as you move into the winter and the leaves fall off the deciduous trees, the CO2 level starts to curve up. So there's a seasonal cycle. And that drop from the maximum CO2 in a given year to the minimum is about 7 parts per million or so. But that peaked in 2008. It was increasing up to about 2008, the drop, and now it's deep declining. And it can only mean that the carbon sinks in the Northern Hemisphere are reducing. And this is very concerning because, you know, a lot of carbon is taken up on the land, but it's also taken up in the oceans. And with ocean stratification, there's less vertical mixing in the ocean, so there's fewer pathways for carbon to go from the ocean surface down to deeper levels where it's sequestered. So this is a huge, basically the massive carbon sinks that soak up tremendous amounts of the CO2 that humans emit are reducing in strength. So the CO2 in the atmosphere is increasing. And then everything cascades, you know, the greenhouse gas effect is more powerful, warming is more powerful, you get more stratification of the oceans. More stresses on vegetation that's growing on the surface, and the CO2 levels then continue to rise up at record rates, which is what we're seeing. So this is very, very concerning, and it's very simple math. You just look at the curve, you know, and average the curve every year and see, you know, how it's changing over time, and you can see that those sinks are declining. So it's a very elegant paper in its simplicity.
It is. We're running out of time, of course, well before we run out of breaking science. We left out scientists finding very large pools of frozen methane in the seas around Antarctica. You make videos about the climate emergency with Dr. Peter Carter, and Carter says so far that Antarctic methane is dissolving into the sea, so it's not quite reaching the atmosphere, it's not affecting the climate yet. And then the Arctic sea ice, which you've been following for decades, I guess the maximum has now passed. Was it a record low again, Paul? What's the situation there?
The sea ice globally is at basically pushing along record lows. So, you know, the Arctic's been sort of declining steadily over the years. Of course, if the ocean currents, the AMOC, shuts off, then that will reverse in the Arctic. You know, I've talked about a blue ocean event where we have less than 1 million square kilometers. So that happens, the minimum occurs in September. So, you know, now we've just passed the peak volume and area extent of sea ice in the Arctic. That's at record lows. So that doesn't bode well for this melt season. Meanwhile, in Antarctica, up until about 2010, 2015, we had an increase of about 1.5% in the extent of sea ice around Antarctica per decade, for many decades, and then that reversed, and the sea ice in Antarctica has basically dropped off a cliff since then, and so it's pushing along at record lows. It just reached its minimum when the Arctic reaches its maximum. Of course, the poles are out of sync in terms of, you know, winter in one, summer in the other pole. So we reached the maximum in the Arctic and the minimum in Antarctica, and if you add those, the ice extends from both together, you get basically record low global amounts of sea ice. So this is only accelerating climate change because it means that the, you know, less sea ice, the darker ocean underneath is exposed, and basically the reflectivity or the albedo of the whole region decreases with less sea ice, so there's more solar absorption and more heating, and you get this, and then back leading back to less ice, etc. So there's all of these nonlinear feedbacks or tipping points or cascades in the climate system, as we know.
Paul Beckwith taught climate science at two Canadian universities, and he takes you along with his journey with his teaching videos now on YouTube at Paul H. Beckwith. Just search for that on YouTube, Paul H. Beckwith, and you're going to find a lot. Find links to all the videos and science that we just talked about in my weekly show blog. It's published Wednesdays at ecoshock.org. Thank you for spending time with us again, Paul.
Thank you, Alex, and as a last thing, I should let people know, if they like my sayings, like connecting the dots on abrupt climate system change, or what happens in the Arctic doesn't stay in the Arctic, they can now go to my son set up an online store called Paul Beckwith Store, and you can get, you know, a t-shirt or a baseball cap with my favorite climate sayings on them, so. Just thought I'd give a little plug, or my son will be upset with me.
All right, we've got it. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. Here is a new song from Radio EcoShock. As usual, my lyrics are set to music by AI. Anyone can use this song or parts of it for any non-commercial purpose. Pass it on. Rotten at the top.
What do I hear? Echoes in the heat, 100,000 people talking with their feet. Crazy old men, heat's gone sour, keep coming back again, holding on to power, bad against the people, got to stop, good on the ground, rotten at the top. Somebody rotten at the top. What do I see?
If we think about where we're heading, let's be clear. We are over 30 years, 32 years now, since the first major scientific report on climate change that came out in 1990. And so I think when we judge where we are heading, we have to say, well, what have we done since 1990? Well, we've watched emissions go up year after year after year. They're now over 60% higher per year than they were in 1990. the trend line tells us that we are heading towards 3 to 4 degrees centigrade of warming across this century, an absolute climate catastrophe. It's a catastrophe for all species, including our own. And so that's the direction of travel.